Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and Caroline won't be able to join us today. Our guest today is Mojgan Gazirad, and she is a medical doctor. She works as an assistant professor of pediatrics at the George Washington University. She holds an MFA in creative writing and has published 3 collections of short stories in Farsi. Her essays have appeared in many periodicals, and she lives with her family in Great Falls, Virginia. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Mojgan.
Thank you, Monica, for inviting me to your program. It's a pleasure to be here.
And the title of your novel is The House on Sun Street, and this is set primarily in Iran around the time of the Iranian Revolution. So I am guessing that you know a lot about that time period.
Of course, I have lived that history, so I know a lot about it.
So The House on Sun Street, the main character is a little girl. At the beginning, she's a little girl. She grows up during this story. Her name is Moji, and she lives through the Iranian Revolution, and it's real, and also comes to America. So how much of this story is your life story?
Yeah, this is a question that so many people ask me, the people who have interviewed me or my readers. It's very interesting that they want to know if this has anything to do with my life. This is a story. It's an autobiographical novel, meaning that I started to write this story and having in mind to write my memories of the events that happened in Iran and in my life. But as I wrote down the story and as the character of Moji was developing on the page, I noticed that she is going a different direction than mine. So that's why I think this is the best to say that even though Moji experiences some of my life event, my life story, but she has a character of her own. And this is a fictional book, and it's a novel rather than being a memoir.
So why do you think that happened? You know, you set out basically to write a memoir, and it's like, is it that you wanted to explore different choices you might have made rather than just the ones you did?
I think that the reason why this because I felt like to say what I wanted to say, it would have been better I created a fictional character rather than myself. Oftentimes, I feel like the stories of our lives, they might be interesting as it is mine has been, but I feel like when you have the character in the novel, they have the life of their own. You create them, they continue to go, and then they abide by the rules of the novel, the story that they are growing in, the environment that they're growing in. And I set her free. I let her do what she wanted to do in that story rather than just saying, oh, this is what I did. You have to do what exactly I did over there.
I love that. I love that. So let's, in terms of the kind of the structure of the story, I'm just curious as to how much is based on your life story. So the house on Sun Street, was this really your grandparents' house?
True. That was my grandparents' house in the central Tehran. And I grew up in eastern part of Tehran, but every Thursday and Friday night, we went to my grandfather's house, which was in central Tehran. And the fact that he started reading 1001 Nights for me is a true thing in my life. And I didn't make that up. I mean, I was fascinated. So one night he brought the book to me and he started to read. I was expecting him to give me like a gift, because he, you know, he went to Hajj pilgrimage many times, and every time he brought just these magical things that like a 5-year-old, 4-year-old is very like eager to see. So I was wondering what this time he's going to do, because he told us that he's going to give us a gift. So at night when he brought this book and started to read, I thought that, wow, what is this, his gift? And then as he started to read, and I felt, okay, wow, even without knowing, I was absorbed by his voice, by the story that he started, the menace that it was in the beginning of the story of 1001 Nights. So he captured me, and that book played a major role in my childhood and later on when I reread it as an adolescent. But yeah, that part is pretty much very real in my own life, and the house that I mentioned in the book, and everything that happens in the house. But obviously, the people are changed. I have more aunts and uncles than the ones that I've written here. So yeah, and but it's pretty much the same. The environment is pretty much the same at the time of Iranian Revolution in Iran.
And do you have a younger sister who's just a year younger than you?
I do. I do.
And a baby brother?
Well, he's not a baby anymore, but yes,
And
I do.
what do they think about their characters in this book?
Yeah. I think that my sister is the one who I was like kind of a bit nervous about, because she's everywhere with me. And I think that she liked it, because pretty much the specific descriptions that I've used in the character is very much like her. She was like an old wise and old wiser than me, even though she was a year younger than me when we were children. So I think she liked it. But my brother keeps saying that, oh yeah, I'm just a baby in your book. I said, well, what can I do?
Well, you could write another one where you're a little older and he's a little older.
Yeah, that's a possibility.
So tell us a little bit about the history of 1001 Nights and why this is
Yeah.
such an important book in, in your culture.
Yeah. So actually 1001 Night has a very interesting story. And even though it is very popular and now everybody knows it in the Western world and in Eastern world, I will say that in Middle East everybody knows about it, and the stories are so widespread that like Persians know it, Arabs know it, Turkish people know it, and they kind of like have it, and then they tell the story to their kids. But apparently what we know is that the origin of the stories are most probably the book was written about 400 to 500 BC, and they think that the author of the book is most probably Queen Homai, which was the daughter and wife of King Bahman at that point. And the stories are coming from the folklore of Persianate culture, or I will say like from the stories of like the central Iran. The original language of the book was Pahlavi, which is the old Persian, the language that old Persian people spoke. But nobody speaks Persian anymore. And unfortunately, the original text of the book is being lost. So we don't have the Pahlavi text. But in Ibn Nadim's contest, which talks about a lot of books at that point, it's a third century like writer, like journalist, like in researcher, they have mentioned this text about 1001 Nights. And over there, it is called Hezar Afsan, meaning 1000 tales. That's the first name of the book in Farsi. Later on, this was translated to Arabic, and because Antoine Galland in 18th century translated the stories to French from the Arabic manuscript, he introduced it as the Arabian world to Western people, and then it came like it was like a hit. Everybody loved it, and I think it was a century maybe later that Richard Burton and John Payne individually they translated to English and how people got to know it in the West. So that's why it carries the world of the Arabian Nights, but many of the stories are coming from the Persian culture. I mean, it has got mixed too, and then you know that you have to bear in mind that it traveled from east, from China to Iran, to India, to Iran, to like Baghdad in Iraq. So there are elements of all that in the book, but there's also some people say that you know there was a connection between Queen Homai and Esther, you know, Esther of this area. So they say that Esther was Queen Homa's grandmother, paternal grandmother. So these stories are kind of connected to the Bible too. So, you know, it's a very interesting and fascinating story.
Oh my.
Yeah.
I didn't realize, I mean, I know the stories in 1001 Nights were being told by a woman. You know, that's kind of the framing of the book, is that she's telling these stories so that her husband doesn't kill her, the king, and because he wants to know what happens the next night. She knows how to leave a cliffhanger, I guess. But I didn't realize that the book itself was written by a woman, which must have been fairly unusual. Well, I mean, not very many books were being written at all back then.
Exactly.
So
yeah, but you see that's the thing. But she was the queen, and so you know that's what they speculate from what they know about her, and they think that Shahrazad is basically Queen Homai.
Cool. Wow. So in both in your life and in your character's life, this book inspired a love of story. Sounds like
that is true. That is true. So I think that my grandfather, I owe him a lot for seeding the imagination in me by telling these stories and keeping them in a suspense mode every time next week coming and making me think about them, what is going to happen next week. So that's how he fed my like my interest and kept me on my toes, and that I always thought what is going to happen next is in this story. So and you know the whole thing is fascinating for a young child because it's you know it is so much of real life in those stories, and there is so much of not real, like fictional characters in it too. They talk about spirits, they talk about ifrits, they talk about divs, jinns. These are like characters who can do evil things or have powerful, who can have powerful power on human beings. So it made me think that, well, everything is possible in the next chapter, and it opened my eyes or kept me thinking that there is going to be always a possibility that in the next chapter. So maybe that's why I became interested in writing stories that have these characteristics.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Mojgan Gazirad, author of The House on Sun Street. Now, this book is in English, did you, but your earlier short story collections were in Farsi, which is the language of Iran, correct? And
True.
was this, did you write this initially in English, or did you write it and then in Farsi and then translate it?
No, I actually wrote this book from the beginning in English, and I mean, at some point, I felt that this book, I felt this book is better to be told in English language rather than being written in Farsi. And I am living in the United States, and I've been living here for over 2 decades now, so I felt like it's time for me to challenge myself and write it in the language of my new home. So, and I was at that point doing my master's in fine arts, MFA in writing, and it became the project for my MFA. And I worked with it. I peer workshopped a lot of the chapters with my mentors, and I'm glad that I did because it not only helped me hone the art and also to hear the criticism about my characters and everything, and taught me how to edit and re-edit, and then to be have a book that I like right now.
I wonder if that would have been more challenging if you'd stuck with memoir in a way to have, the input from other people, because you can't really, your characters are who they are, and you and what happens is what happens in memoir. But like you say, with fiction, you can make changes and make to make the
Yeah.
story better.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, although I wonder how often people actually kind of fudge things a little bit in memoir to make the
That's
story
very
better.
true, actually. I think that these days people are making a lot of changes to their memoirs. I know that there are things happening in memoir that you might not say that it's 100% has happened. But I felt like it was easier for me to have it in this shape. It was easier for my family, especially for my dad, who had reservations from the minute I started writing this book. And
Well, let's
so,
talk about that a
and
little
then
bit.
when he, yeah, and then when I read the first part for him, which is like he's heavily involved in that first part as a child, he said, "Well, no, well, why are you going to go ahead? So this is not the way it was." And I said, "Okay, Dad, I think that I don't really want to make you upset with this book." So, yeah.
Okay, so in The House on Sun Street, Moji's father was a soldier in the Shah's army, was an officer in the Shah's
Yes,
army.
he was an officer in Shah's army, and actually he did come to the United States 4 days after, before the Iranian Revolution. It just happened by chance, I mean, and he got the visa to study in University of Alabama. I mean, why there? I don't know. I have no idea, but apparently because a family member was there and they like helped to get this case. You know, at that point there was no email or something like that. Everything was in letters and it took forever and they had to make phone calls. And so he got that admission and we came to the United States when he came. So after him, actually.
Yeah, but then you went back. He went back to Iran after the revolution.
Yeah, and then of course he was a high officer, I mean, high-ranking officer in Shah's army, and now is coming back 2 years after the revolution when the interrogations are getting the highest of its point. Everybody is suspicious, especially my dad, who has left Iran 4 days before the Iranian revolution and comes back, and all these rumors, and they're asking, and then, where are you going? To the country of the great Satan, as they call us at that time in Iran. So of course his case was something that had a big like a mark on it, so they investigated his stay and they wanted to know more.
I mean, Wasn't he afraid to return? Wouldn't it have been safer for him to have stayed? You were here, you know.
I mean, yes, that is true. I mean, I always wonder, but you know, I think at that point, maybe, you know, now we know a lot about the people who are governing Iran. So we know the regime now. But that 2 years after, you know, it was not clear who these people are. And, you know, when the Iranian Revolution happened, there were a lot of groups. It was just not the Islamists or the mullahs that are right now. There were nationalists, there were communists, that they were all, it was a joint effort between them all. And so many people thought that it's going to be a better way. And honestly, the atrocities happened years after when the Islamists took over and actually got everybody out of the government, I mean, the governance of the country out. They executed all the Communist Party leaders and nationalists. So then they monopolized and did what they did and what they're continuing to do right now.
I mean, it seems like an
idea. He might be dangerous, but at the same time, I don't know if he realized how critical and dangerous
right.
that
and,
could
and
have been.
We didn't have the internet back then. You probably weren't as aware. Like you said, no email. You wouldn't have the access to what was really going on to know how dangerous it actually was.
Yes.
And, you know, it's interesting because I feel like in this book, in The House on Sun Street, I learned a lot about how the revolution sort of divided families and how many, you know, many, many people supported the cause of the revolution. It seemed like even your father, who was a high-ranking officer in the Shah's army, was and was loyal to the Shah, but kind of understood to some degree why people wanted more freedom, wanted, you know, that the Shah had done some horrible things, that people had been mistreated, and that the people who backed Khomeini, how do you actually pronounce his name?
That's right,
Khomeini. Yeah, thought that he would be so much better, and yet, you know, his government ended up committing the same atrocities, just to different people.
Even worse,
against different people. And it's sad because it points out how frequently that happens, that, you know, they say power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think this is an example of that, that once they got in power, they were even more corrupt. Yeah.
Than the ones that they were, like, former government of Iran. So, yeah, that is very true. I mean, the divide in the families that you say, it was something that as a child, like, I could see it in every single gathering that we had, how my core family, which were my mother and father, like, thought differently than my uncles and aunts, especially one of them, that they were had different mindset. And this is not something that happened only in my family. I know that families had these, like, deep divides between them, that, like, one father was supporting the Revolutionary Guard, and the son was had joined a communist party, and then the father had gone and reported the son, and they executed the son. This is not a story. These happened in Iran.
Oh my gosh.
Or this on the other way around, that the son had gone and reported the father, and they arrested him, and they were brutal. I mean, there was it was not like a court going to be held for these people and claims be evaluated. No, I mean, there was just this was a clergyman sitting back there and deciding who will live and who won't, and they'll tell them, okay, you have done this, and then they just execute it like that without even having them to back or without even letting people to have their own lawyers. This was not happening. This doesn't happen in revolutions. Just people get executed because of, and there is a scene in my book, I don't know if you remember, that Moji is having some books of the Communist Party, is reading some Communist Party, and her father becomes furious and tells her, like, are you naive? Are you not living in this country? Do you know that kids can get executed for just carrying a Communist Party book? And that was very real. I mean, they killed and executed a huge amount of Iranian youth at that point, just because of like having these like journals, daily journals of Communist Party, an accusation that they are members of the Communist Party in Iran. So then they will go as low as like 13 years old, 14 years old, 15 years old. These people, I mean, and then you know that this is all a huge, like a story about 8 years after the beginning of the Iranian Revolution, that this happened in Iran, that they executed thousands of people, and the names are all out. So yeah, so this was a scary time for us, and as you said, we got used to living in such a terror state. Every day seeing that somebody gets executed, or people come and say, oh, they caught that person, and that person is no longer, it's in Evin, it's in the prison. It was terrible times.
Wow. You must really be grateful that your father was released under those circumstances, that they didn't continue to hold him and or execute him, but you didn't know for weeks.
Exactly.
Wow.
That's true.
Do your parents still live in Iran?
No, actually, they're both in the United States.
Okay.
They came before me. I mean, I stayed in Canada for a while, but then they came before me.
So how were they able to get out again? Is it hard to be able to leave?
I think that after they cleared, and it was like years later. I mean, it was like they came out maybe about 15 years.
So
15 years after the revolution. Yeah, things changed, you know. So
like today, is it hard for someone to leave Iran, or is it only hard for them to find some place to go?
That's hard for them to find some place to go.
Yeah.
But then it's not hard to leave Iran. It's hard to find some place to go. And the problems in Iran are right now mostly financial. People don't have the means, financial means, because, you know, there's a lot of economic strain on people back in Iran. And so that's why they don't, even if they want to, they are not able to get the financial means to leave the country. And then, unfortunately, many places do not grant them, like, visas to go to. So it's not hard to get out of Iran for majority of people. Obviously, if people who are still, like, involved in active members of some organizations that Iran thinks that they are still a terrorist organization, they call them, it's difficult for them to come and go. But for the majority of people, it's not.
Well, that's good, at least. So how does what's happening there, how does your book sort of relate to some of the protests that we saw in Iran in recent years?
Yeah. So as you can see, my book talks about how all this obligatory hijab started in Iran as a from this vantage point of Moji. She comes back and she realizes now she has to go to school, and now for going to school she has to wear this hijab, which is something for an 8-year-old is not obligatory, but then they made it obligatory for everybody who wants to go to school. So the seeds are that planted at that time in Iran, when the 2 years after the revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini kind of made it mandatory for all women to wear. And then it was not just that you have to, or we recommend you doing it, or you have to. If you weren't doing it, they were punishing women there. I mean, the people were, these revolutionary guards were around in the cities, and then they all doing this, you know, these cars that they had people sitting in them, the security force, I mean, the revolutionary guards. It was like going back all the way back to that time in the revolution, that they were looking around, seeing if a woman was not wearing a hijab, they were arresting her, punishing her. And then there were like motorcycle people who were squirting acid in the faces of women who weren't really wearing that. So they were kind of like creating this terror state for a woman, and if you don't oblige, you are going to get hurt, or you're so. This has been ongoing for a long time.
Now, initially, the hijab was, you just wore a small scarf, and that was okay, or
no, no, there was no hijab at all at the time of the Shah in Iran.
Well, I know, but when you started wearing the hijab, it sounded like in the school that they were like colorful scarves in the beginning.
In the beginning it was, as I said, but as things got like they got more aggressive, and they created codes for women who they have to wear, you know. And that's the time that, okay, so they created the codes. Whoever not like abiding by those codes and rules for like what they should wear, they are going to get punished. And that's how they like kind of became organized in what they were doing. And these revolutionary guards, and then they made a special police for like going around in the streets to see if women are doing this or not. And this all this thing that happened in 2022. Mahsa, you know, Amini was coming from the same route, the same
oh,
route.
Yeah.
The people, yeah.
Why do
yeah,
you
so
think,
they were there. And
why do you think, like, your aunt in the book, who was, you know, helped, was part of the revolution, and then afterwards she's wearing this full, not just hijab, but what are some of the other articles of clothing?
Chadors, you mean chadors?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, they were youth, and then they were, you know, as you mentioned, they were critical of what Shah had done at that point, and they were wanting change in the better way. And Ayatollah Khomeini came with a lot of, like, words that he's going to make things better, a lot of promises that unfortunately weren't true, or didn't come to become true, as he mentioned. So they were fond of him. Believe it or not, Khomeini was a charismatic leader in Iran.
Yeah, yeah.
And so many people loved him. And they wanted to, and then this was like a motto in Iran. And they said that if he says so, we are going to die for him. This is how immensely people loved him in Iran. So then he came by and said, well, this is what Islam says for a woman, and if you want to be a good Muslim, you need to wear this and wear that. And so they just listened to him. And she was among them, like one of them that she wanted to do, and she did. Like many others, she was not the only one. There was a divide in the country.
Yeah, it's hard for me to understand how women voluntarily give up their independence and freedom to accept that. Did she ever change her mind as she got older and saw the promises weren't being kept?
Well, you know, the story of her is a sad one, because I think that she, if she wanted to even exchange. Then she married to a very traditional family of Bazaar who are very religious. So I don't really think that she kind of like believes in the promises of the government anymore, but she still observes the hijab. And you know that there is still a section of like, I would say there is a section, a percentage of Iranian women that are still like very much observing the hijab based on their Islamic beliefs. So they are traditional, and then they are not like, I would say that they don't share the same views as other majority of women in Iran.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Mojgan Gazirad, author of The House on Sun Street. And Mojgan, would you please read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure. I think that I would like to read from a part that Moji and her family come back to Iran, and she is kind of like surprise of the changes that had happened. I could hear the throbbing pulse in my ears as we landed at Mehrabad Airport. It was hard to wait in the aisles to get off the plane. After almost 2 years, I was about to see Aghajoun and Azra again. But as soon as I walked down the stairs, I noticed a stark difference in the appearance of the land and people around me. My eyes were so accustomed to Huntsville vivid shades of green that I'd totally forgotten the gray and clay of my homeland. Camouflage uniformed men with guns wandered in the hallways between the gates. Women, the ones who worked in the airport and almost everyone who had come to greet the passengers, wore hijab on their heads. Maman had also covered her hair with a small silk scarf, her long black tresses dangling on her shoulders. To my utter disappointment, neither Aghajoun nor Azra had come to the airport. Saba and Reza were waiting for us instead. The biggest surprise came when we saw Saba among the welcoming crowd. None of us recognized her at first. She was wearing a black chador, covering every inch of her body as if she had transformed into a shapeless black rolling sack without hands or feet. Maman placed her hands on her face in astonishment as soon as she saw Saba, wondering if this was the sister she'd left in Tehran. I felt I was being engulfed by a bulky dough when she hugged me with the sack. She braced Maman and Marmar, kissed Mo in Maman's arms, but refused to shake hands with Baba. Baba stared at her with surprise and drew back his empty hand. Reza appeared different as well. His beard had grown many inches longer, and it had become an essential part of his face. His collarless white shirt hung over his pants, and he had folded down the heel of his monk shoes to make them like the sandals of the mullahs. He greeted us with a smile, but he didn't ask a single question about our life in the United States. Aghajoun never mentioned anything about Saba or Reza in his letters, other than them being fine. I felt the icy wall that separated them from us. They had metamorphosed into alien creatures of 1001 nights during the past 2 years. This was not the encounter I dreamed of on the way back home. I flew between the fluffy clouds, longing for the radiant rays of kindred love that had illuminated the house on Sun Street. I was waiting for the moment I could hug Aghajoun and tell him about our life in America. I wanted to circle my hands around Azra's neck and fill my lungs with the rose perfume she wore in the triangle of her long neck, her shoulders, and the rim of her flora chador. The sweet scent of home inhabited that triangle, different from the saccharine-filled marshmallow fragrance I'd gotten used to in the United States. A poignant pressure squeezed my heart as I entered the gloomy, polluted dusk of Tehran.
And that was Mojgan Gazelrod reading from The House on Sun Street. Now, one of the things I noticed throughout the book is you write a lot about food.
True.
Now, Moji is...
Okay, I love writing about food.
Moji is a very picky eater and isn't, and as a result, is smaller than her younger sister. Yes. And yet she thinks about food a lot.
So I think that's the characteristic of people who are obsessed with food. You can be in love with food or you can be hating the food, but you're thinking about food all the time. So I was from the category that they didn't like food, but they were thinking about food because she was always forced to eat food and she didn't want to. But I think the other reason was is just because of the culture of my family. You know, my grandmother was great cook, and she made everything from scratch, meaning that she made preserves, she made different herbs, she was so knowledgeable about everything, and she knew different dishes. And then she actually like worked to make to provide that even not for her own family, but her own or for her children's family too. So that's why I learned a lot from her as I was standing and staying with her. And then my connection with her was with food. And because I loved her so much, I think that was the reason, that was the main reason I had this connection with food in my book.
Ah, all right. What are some of the native foods that you write about in the book?
Sure. Yeah, so there's a famous herb meat and curry that they make in Iran. It is called forme sabzi. So it's made from with spring onions and cilantro and parsley, and then they chop them and they fry them and they add them to lamb stew. With kidney beans, and it's just one of my favorite. And it's very the making of it is cumbersome, but the memory of how my grandmother cleaned all those herbs and cut them and fried them and then added them together is something that was etched in my memory, and that has a part in the book. Also, how she made akshay reshte, which is a noodle soup, and she made the noodles herself. So I loved playing with the dough and making the noodles with her.
My granddaughter, when she was little, used to like making noodles with me.
That's amazing.
Okay. Yep, yep. And I use my grandmother's noodle recipe.
That's amazing. Yeah, I know. I think it's such an essential part of any culture, like an old culture, how women prepare food in that culture. I mean, not necessarily in every culture, but actually in our culture, women prepare food.
And I got the idea from different sections that you normally eat on the floor.
Exactly. That's how a Persian Iranian, I mean, traditional Iranians or older generation, they did. We did everything on the floor. And that's because they had those beautiful rugs on the floor, and then we slept on the floor, and we ate on the floor, and we sat on the floor with bolsters around the room. So that's how my grandfather's house was. Our house was not like that. And we had a modern looking house, like more like a French style, but then they did have everything on the floor. And it was like part of the ceremony to put the cover on the floor and then like arrange everything. And then in a traditional Iranian home, it wasn't like you had a set up bed already. There were mattresses that they were folded, pretty much like Japanese, pretty much the same. The mattresses are unfolded at night, and then that people sleep on them, and then they got folded again and then stored. So then they use the space. It was like this everywhere in Iran in
I
all
w
the rages. But yeah.
Were Persians originally a nomadic people, do you think, centuries ago? Is that where that would have come from,
Before they
possibly?
established, I think that was before the establishment of their kingdom, but no, they were
No.
pretty, no, they were pretty urban, and they were like in entire cities. But this was the tradition from a long time. Even it's very interesting that you're asking. Like, I mentioned Marmar Museum in Tehran, which a lot of belongings of Reza Shah, which is the founder of the Pahlavi dynasty, is was kept there. So I my aunt took me there to see a couple of times. I went to that Marmar Museum, and in that museum there was a section like showing the belongings of Reza Pahlavi, and that his mattress and his bolster was on display, showing that he slept on the floor on that mattress and that bolster. So
Okay, so definitely very strong tradition.
it
And
is.
yeah, I'm just kind of curious about why certain cultures would have all this furniture and others
Yeah,
not.
I think
And
yeah.
is there not a lot of forest for
I
wood?
think that I think this is no. I think this is more like because of the, I think about the weather and about the geology of the country. You know, like in Western countries, the soil is very cold and the cold climate, so people have to like sleep higher from the floor. But in Iran, it wasn't like that, and they had these like woolen rugs, and then they put the mattresses on them and slept on
Ah,
the.
okay.
And
Okay.
actually, in central parts of Iran, which is hot and dry, like desert, some parts of it, people even go down into the basement, meaning that the structures go down into basement to make it cool, and then people sleep on the floor, which is very cold and
Well,
very pleasant, especially in summertime.
so natural air conditioning.
I think so. I
Yes.
think that this basically how they accommodated based on the climate.
So, Mojgan, let's talk a little bit about how you got this book published. So, you were working, it was your master's thesis, you were doing an MFA, you're also a medical doctor, so I'm assuming you keep pretty busy
I am very busy, actually. Yeah,
that.
writing this book. Writing this book had its own challenges, but publishing had it even more challenging than the writing the book. So, which one do you want me to talk
Well,
about?
let's talk about writing first. So,
Sure.
did you take a sabbatical from your medical
Okay.
practice so you could focus on
Okay.
this MFA, or were you doing both at the
Okay.
same time?
Okay, so I'll tell you first of all, like about my job. So as a critical care doctor, I do not have a like a 8 to 5 time to go to clinic and see patients because I don't work outpatient. I am 100% of my time clinical in the hospital, in the ICU. So in the ICU and everywhere in the United States, and I think in the world, the physicians work shift works, meaning that you are there for a certain amount of time and you come and you don't have any clinical duties. So I think that my job really helped me because it helped me in a way that I didn't have to go ahead and be there all the time, so I could take a break. So I did my shifts, like if I did a 16-hour, 24-hour shift, then this is how I'm also continuing to write, that I do my shifts, I do one or two in the week, and then the rest of the week is mine. Obviously, the first day I have to still like get to sleep and rest, but the other days I can actively work on my writing project. So for doing my MFA, I did a low residency, as you might be aware of how low residencies are. You start with a semester in, you don't have to be on campus when you're doing low residency MFA. So I was at the beginning of Yeah, the semester I went there for like 8 to 10 days, stayed in New Hampshire, and then I worked through the rest of the semester with my mentor, when I was in the DC area. So I sent all my papers to them, so I built a routine of that. So I do write the days that I don't go to work and I am well rested. Like, for example, tomorrow, I worked last night, so I came home, I get some rest, I am doing an interview, and tomorrow is going to be a writing day for me because I will not go to work.
So, on your writing days, do you have a set schedule? Are you very disciplined about it?
Yes, well, I am pretty disciplined when I am. I like when I started writing a novel, I start early in the morning, so I am an early riser. I do write early in the mornings and then do like readings and things rest that are related to writing in the afternoons.
And why do you think you want to have both of these careers? They can both be very demanding careers in a way. What's
Well,
motivating you to do this?
I think it's the love of writing. I really enjoy my time writing. I feel like it gives me a sense of satisfaction and pleasure the days that I write. I was an avid book reader. I'm still an avid book reader, and words are my world, you know, even though I felt like I kind of like took a different path. Maybe if I was living, continued to live and study in the United States, I would have become a literary academic and then did write. So it's just the sometimes life brings things for you that you're quite And that was the same. And at that point in Iran, you know, that my parents really wanted me to do medicine, and
Now,
they didn't foresee.
even after the Islamic Revolution, women were able to get a university education and
They
become
did,
and
yes.
medical doctors and so forth, because in some places
No, in Iran,
it's
women are strong. They couldn't really like get us. They couldn't really delete us. And if they really made this, they really made the effort to do this. And they're kind of like limiting women. But Iranian women are resilient. You can see what happened last year. They fight for everything. And so I think that this is like, we fought for this. So many like they were not really wanting this. They said it's fine as long as you wear the hijab, you can do it. I would not say that there were discriminatory. There are jobs that women cannot do in Iran. Like, for example, they cannot become judges. They cannot lead the country. They cannot become clergies to like lead a group of people. They can have the knowledge for their own. But medicine was something that they needed, so they kept it. So, and now I think now it is much better. At that point, it was way harder. Now it is easier for to get into university. And at some point, the majority, I think like 50 to 60% of the entrance exam, I mean, the students were females. Just because there were more of them.
Now, the parents in the house on Sun Street are secular. They're not religious. And how prevalent was that in Iran at that time, and how prevalent is it now to be secular?
I think it was prevalent. There is a percentage of Iranians that, as I said, are traditionally like practicing Muslims, but there were many secular families. I remember that when I went to school, so many kids were like me and my parents. And I think right now they're even more.
And
They're
they
even
didn't
more.
force you, although they strongly encouraged it, they didn't force you to go to the prayer sessions. I found
They
that
never,
interesting.
they never, they didn't. You mean in school or in
Yeah,
my house?
in school.
No, they didn't force because you know they highly recommended it, but you know, I don't know. They maybe it was just because of the religion that you cannot force anybody. It's a verse from Quran that says that you cannot force people to become Muslim. I mean, but so they say this, but they say, oh, it's highly recommended, but no, they couldn't. I
So
mean,
we
I know in
only
some places they did, though.
yeah. We
Some
only have a
places, like
couple
in
minutes left, so let's real quickly talk about how you found your publisher.
Okay. Yes. So it took me, after I finished my book, I edited a few more times when I finished my MFA thesis, because at that point it was just a story. It needed a lot of work. Finding an agent was very difficult for me. Like, as you know, it's hard to find an agent. So it took me about a year to find an agent who really loved the book, and she decided to represent my book. But then she had difficulty selling the book because it wasn't something that many publishers were maybe interested. It was from the minority, I would say. So, and then we also hit the time of the pandemic, which nobody was interested in buying the book, and so everything was on stop. I was also busy at that point to follow up with my agent, so we just like didn't have time. Never had time to follow up with her, and so it took me, I think, 3 years to she it took her 3 years to sell the book. But she had the persistence, and every time I got disappointed, she said, no, this is a good book, you will sell it. And then I made a little bit of a diff changes, and then the last time I said, well, maybe I should bring a part from her adolescence to the beginning of the book, so people like just don't say no just at the get-go and say, oh, there's another story about the Iranian Revolution. So I think this trick worked, and then a couple publisher liked the book, and they showed interest, and then I decided to go with Blair.
With Blair
And
and
interesting is that then they also su suggested me, can we get that part back to where it is and start from where you. And I said, well, this is where I wanted to start the book. I just brought this up so that you guys know what is in the book.
So Blair Publishing, it's a nonprofit publisher, as they say, and they do 10 to 12 books a year. I'm looking at their catalog, and one of my favorite interviews I did this year was from their catalog too, the Key West Sketches, Writers at Mile Zero. I love that one. And yeah, so this is I think you're
It's
in a
a
good
very nice
place.
publisher. Yeah, I
Yeah.
really enjoyed working with my editor and my publisher. They have been very supportive, and they have helped me. If there was concerns or anything, they addressed it very very they were very attentive to me, which I don't know. I don't have any other experience, but I hear from my friends, my writer friends, that they say this you have found a good publisher.
Well, I think so. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Mojgan. And we always
Thank you
end
so much for having me.
we always end with a quote, and I found a quote that's attributed to Edward Powis Mathers, who was one of the translators of the Arabian Nights. So, and I think this is from the Arabian Nights, but it really fits this your book. A library of books is the fairest garden in the world, and to walk there is an ecstasy.
Amazing. Yeah, you're right. I think it goes very much like for my book.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.